Rich is the CEO of Omni, but he's also worked across a number of different industries. And we have a little bit of a chat about what it looks like and the similarities no matter what the business that we're operating in. Hi, Richard. Thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast. So, Richard, you are the CEO of Omni. Do you want to tell us a little bit about Omni for those who don't know? Most people probably do.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, certainly for most people within the, you know, the built environment, we're a fire engineering and fire protection consulting services business. Other than a residential home, we pretty well work across every single sector. You know, we do a lot of health related projects, hospitals, certainly up here in Queensland. We do a lot of rail. So Cross River Rail is, you know, for those that are up in Queensland might know of Cross River Rail, you know, in Sydney. There's Harbourside, so that's this, you know, the massive project on Darling Harbour, and anything from the casino up here as well to commercial buildings, defence work, education, right across the board.
And I think it's one of those things, you know, I was talking to somebody the other day, you know, a few years ago, decades ago, as we were talking about before, you know, fire wasn't necessarily one of those things that people were focused on. I was thinking about it yesterday. I was somewhere, I was going, yeah, we just don't have the disasters that we used to have because now everything is so well engineered and thought about. And fire is one of those things where we're not seeing the deaths that we would have had decades ago. Now, I'm going to put that in, you know, obviously there's been the London, you know,
Grenfell Tower
and stuff like that. But, you know, why is fire one of those really important elements, and why has it become so crucial to particularly complex buildings needing them?
And absolutely, it's not kind of the shiny, sexy element of a building or a design. It's, you know, it's the sprinkler heads. It's the materials that go into the, you know, to the walls. It's the way that you set up different performance solutions. But it's about life safety. And that's what I get a lot of joy, knowing that the work that the technical people do within our business is all about preserving life, is all about, you know, creating an environment. So touch wood, if something bad happens, we can enable people to get out of that environment in a safe and orderly way. And so, yeah, you know, and what I've found since joining the industry, I now, you know, I'm in different buildings and I'm looking at sprinkler head designs and I'm looking at, you know, the exit, looking at where they've got fire extinguishers. And it's funny, all of a sudden, you know, if you buy a red car, all of a sudden you see a bunch of red cars. And I think it's that same sort of thing. It's really apparent and it's really front of mind for me. And most places that I go now, I'm really aware of the infrastructure that's in place.
It's quite funny. It's a bit like, you know, when I started working in the design industry, I didn't know, but now I'll like go in, I'll touch and I'll walk into a building, and then, you know, working with a bunch of different engineers, I'll look at the vertical transport and I'm thinking, okay, yeah, what was this? And what's the flow that we're having of what people are coming out? Fire engineering, what are we doing? What's actually put in there? Walking into a theatre and thinking, okay, how has this actually been acoustically designed, or all these elements. And it is one of the most rewarding, because you and I are quite similar in that way. We work in this industry, but we've got a background in different industries and a bit industry agnostic in that way. But the fantastic things about these amazing professionals and all the elements that, you know, even the materials that need to be built, where are they coming from? Where are they being sourced? How are they actually being constructed? It's a fascinating industry, absolutely indeed. So I have a similar experience to yourself. So on that, probably a really good sort of segue into, tell us a little bit about, obviously you're the CEO, but tell us a little bit about, you've got a very varied history and some fantastic transferable knowledge and skills across.
Yes, I've been really fortunate. I've leaned into, you know, learning and development, and you do that by being on the tours and by making mistakes, and that's certainly been the best teacher for me in my time. But I've also done some tertiary study, which I think has given me an academic perspective of the things that you live and breathe every single day. But what I had learned many years ago is kind of this baseline, you know, skills and experience that I continue to develop and evolve. And then, you know, very early days, if you're Park Hospitality, which we're now getting back into the 90s, you know, I spent quite a few years working in travel and I love the travel industry and I love traveling now. And then I moved from travel over into, you know, into media as it was. And then I moved into financial services and insurance and, you know, multiple years across each of these different sectors. And then I moved in to run a shared service procurement business, specifically set up and designed to provide third-party risk management for, in the end, we had 17 different credit unions that we partnered with, and we also wow. set up a law firm. I'm not a lawyer, probably a bush lawyer at best, but we set up a law firm in order to provide, you know, I suppose expand the way that we're looking after them. And yeah. and what I learned is, you know, yes, there are nuances to every sector, and that's fine, but the underlying fundamentals that are the same: people, process, systems, structure, culture. Need to run and make good commercial decisions. And when you lean into that and focus on that, you know, and it's like even now I work with amazing subject matter experts that are specialists in their field by way of, you know, fire engineering and fire protection services. But I don't need to be that technical expert in order to work effectively with them. What I need to do is create an environment. And there's one thing I say to my leadership team a lot, as leaders and the people that, you know, run the business, you know, we have a responsibility to give everyone that comes here all the tools that they need to be successful in their role. We need to train them and show them how to use all of those tools effectively and successfully. And then you need to give them a period of time with which to use all of those tools effectively and efficiently. And so I constantly lean back into kind of those attributes. And again, I have technical people that are, you know, are aligned and work directly with me. And I don't try and cross over and be the technical expert, but I try and create an environment where, you know, they can focus on what matters, they can have meaningful conversations, and they can focus on the most impactful, I suppose, tasks and actions that are moving the needle.
Well, and that, I think that's it. I mean, it's about strategy, it's about execution, and then it's about actually making it happen. Because sometimes people write strategies and they sit in the bottom drawer, or sometimes people talk, oh, it's this, and it's like, you've actually got to get all of your people aligned. But what are you doing to set people up for success? At the end of the day, people generally, particularly in professional services businesses, they are the biggest cost. Right. But they are also the point of difference of what you have. It is about those relationships, how they're interrelating with each other. But it is also about how as a collective we're coming together and executing, particularly when you're rolling or running an organization with multiple different locations as well. I often talk about it's a little bit like a family. You know, you've got the same values and that, but every single different disciplines, you know, every single element or child has a different personality. But how do we come together with the same values and alignment of where we're heading?
Agreed.
And I think that's the interesting part. As you said, you've sort of found across industries, it doesn't matter. It's the people, process and the execution that you're actually going to do. So lots of talk is one thing. Actually making it happening is the other side of things as well. And that's generally what a good CEO actually does as well.
Good to know. I might be in the ballpark.
So look, outside of obviously what you do on a day-to-day, you also run your own e-commerce on a side, so you're also a cycler. You just mentioned that you've just gone and done base camp as well. So tell us a little bit about the other things that you've sort of got a drive outside of just the boardroom.
Yeah, so I had some health issues, won't labour that. Over a decade ago now, and then that kind of shoehorned me into what was originally a year of yoga, and then I'm like, oh my goodness, I need to do something different, and then I jumped on a bike, and then you start, for those that cycle, you probably very well understand the evolution that people navigate through from, I'll only ever wear active wear to then I'd never wear Lycra, and then I've got to wear courtesy shorts over my Lycra because that's weird, and then all of a sudden, well, I have more Lycra than probably most other outfits in my house. But then through that, you also then learn, spend a lot of money on bikes, and you spend a lot of money on outfits. And maybe almost 6 years ago, just riding with some mates and some big brands out there, and they're very expensive. And so we are having a chat, and you know, there's lots of chat as you're cycling around the place, and you know, sort of banter around, oh, we should do this ourselves. And then I sort of just thought, well, let's take it one step further, and picked a couple of mates that I, you know, regularly would ride with, and said, hey, how about we actually let's do this. And they were both immediately in. I'm like, that's great. Now go and have a chat with your wives and get alignment on the home front. Yeah. And then they got alignment, and sort of 6 years later, everyone's got full-time jobs and it's all e-commerce based, and we're just kind of ticks along on the side, and we get free kit
E-commerce is not an easy business to do. Obviously, you know, Australia, we pay a lot in for clothing and things like that. And when you're into cycling, it's the next level. So, you know, sorry, how much for what? Oh my God. Like, there's a lot of brand out there. I know, being a cyclist, you kind of get to that. And then, you know, it's like, oh, you buy this bike and then you buy this bike. And then you start looking, you're like, oh, that's just $10,000-$20,000 bike. You're like, how is somebody paying this much for a bike to save a few grams on? You kind of got to get your ego out of it.
Yeah.
But then it is one of those things where e-commerce is actually very much a digital business. It's also about holding, obviously, stock. And, you know, you explained it more to me because you obviously have gone through that journey as well.
Yeah, and so literally you just, like, from the very beginning, we source everything internationally, and it's like, oh, how do you even find a manufacturer? Yeah. You go on Google and you literally just start Googling, and then you reach out and you have some conversations, and then you get some samples, and it takes many months, and you get a bunch of different types of samples, and you wear them, you ride in them, you wash them, you ride in them again, and then you finally go, hey, this is a really good quality product. And then you start looking at the different price points, and then, you know, learn things the wrong way around. What would have been really good is work out a brand, then get some samples, because you've actually already got your logo on it. We did it back to front. We got a bunch of samples. Then we figured out a logo. Then we needed to get more samples. So, you know, you make these mistakes along the way. But it's about, we run lean. We have lean margins. Yeah, so I know what the landed price is for most jerseys in Australia. And we, you know, we're under 20% gross margin that we put on it. And I know different brands out there, and hey, good on you. You have a good brand.
You've got overheads, you know, once you get to a certain brand. It was interesting.
Yeah, some of them are making 3,000%+ every day of the week. And that doesn't sit well with me as a, you know, as a passionate cyclist. And that was one of the reasons why we did Third World Cycling, just because we thought, you know, I don't think that's about the community. That's about the business, and we're about the community. And so we have a really good quality product, and we sell it at a price point, which makes it really affordable.
We'll ensure we include that in for any of the cyclists out there. I'll certainly be checking it out after this, you know, I might have to say. All right, so tell us a little bit. So generally what we do is we also talk about a bit of the challenges and the opportunities. So obviously there's a lot going on in the Australian economy at the moment, and now you're based mainly in Australia. Across, you've got offices in Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne.
Yes.
Yep, but you also work across Australia and Perth and others, being a specialist firm as well.
Yes.
So, I mean, we sort of do see a bit of a difference happening, let's say, the Victorian market, I suppose, and that's driven by government and what government's been spending and confidence down there versus the New South Wales market versus what's happening in Queensland. It's a little bit of a move and a change. But obviously then, because you work also in defence and other parts, there's a federal element as well. And there's a lot going on. We're recording this on the 21st of May at the moment, and obviously there's a lot going on internationally and politically. There's lots of things happening on a technology point of view on what that's going to look like for businesses, I think, over the next sort of 5 years. What do you see as some of the biggest challenges across the industry at present?
I think, you know, if we ring fence it to different environments and you think about Victoria, you know, I've had a conversation with a lot of people and I get down there regularly, and there's a continued discussion, which is there's a lack of opportunity, there's a lack of projects which are out there. And then we were doing with one of our senior fire engineers down there yesterday, who runs the Victorian team, our pipeline of opportunity is loaded, and we have not at capacity, but there is a lot of work for all the team which are down there, and that's across fire engineering and fire protection services. And so, and I get it, and maybe for some other organizations there are some hard times, and it's not like they will organically just come to us. We're out there and you know, you're maintaining relationships and you're making sure that when you are given an opportunity to work on a project, you do it well. You know, it's not just about churn through it and make it as profitable. You know, our guys definitely lean in towards, you know, quality over quantity from that perspective. But really interesting down there. Yeah, like I hear a lot of people talk about the strain that the Victorian market is under. And we certainly experience challenges, as every organization does. But it was really...
You're thinking there's good green shoots ahead.
There's opportunities out there for all those that are willing to lean into it, chase it down, and, you know, do what's required in order to try and secure some of that work.
And how are you finding the New South Wales market in comparison?
New South Wales, we're pretty small there. We've been fortunate. We also have some excellent clients. We work with quite a lot of different tier one companies that are out there, and they trust us because of the specialty work that we do, and they continue to come back and work with us, which is a great compliment in itself. So I think there is significant upside opportunity in Sydney that we haven't fully realized, and we have regular kind of business development discussions around how we continue to grow and evolve within that particular market. And then you kind of keep moving north and you go Queensland. And again, we've got a lot of opportunity that it continues to come through to us. We are super active out there in market, you know, preserving relationships, trying to establish new ones, you know, making sure that when we are given an opportunity to work on a project, we do a really good job, and then try and set ourselves up for success where we can be viewed favorably for future work as well. The other side, I suppose, of the coin up here, if you think about the pipeline of work 2032, lots of people talk about Olympics, and we've been fortunate. We're on some Olympic projects. And so that's really great. Not all of them, but we've got some good ones in there. But from housing to all the other infrastructure projects that, you know, have been earmarked or approved to be delivered, mm-hmm. It's like there's a large volume of projects that need to get funneled into a very narrow window. I think there'll continue to be some resource challenges. You know, I think migration was, you know, part of the federal government, and won't go political, but there's been a heavy focus on, you know, opening the gates and allowing, you know, people to move to Australia. But I think the government needs to be far more deliberate about the types of people that they want to promote to come here. And I think getting in a bunch of people that have a degree of skills but aren't necessarily associated with the construction industry and building new infrastructure inhibits our ability to achieve, you know, to achieve what's required. I was out riding this morning at 4:30 this morning, and I was listening to a podcast, and it was about the budget, because that's what you do. You listen to a podcast about politics while you're riding around Brisbane at 5 a.m. And so of all of GDP, all of the GDP spend, 25% comes from the federal government. So you think about all the money that's spent in Australia, 25% comes from the Fed. And then you include state government as a part of that. That takes it up to 40% of our GDP. So it is significant. And I'm not aligned with some of the decisions that have been made of late at that federal level. And let's not go down that rabbit.
A lot of business people aren't, but yeah.
Yeah, and I don't think they should be. But you think about that volume of spend, and you've got a, you know, they're trying to get more money out of a, you know, the people that are out there and trying to have a crack and trying to run a business and the owners of businesses. And it's like, you got to try and set these people up for success, not try and get more money out of them so you can fill up your own
Funny, actually. We have opened a little bit of that door. On the weekend, I had a conversation with a friend who's an entrepreneur, runs businesses across the world as well, right? And we had that, and they're accountant. And we had that conversation. I said, how do you feel about some of these changes? If those people listening aren't aware, there's some obviously parts around tax, around a lot of CGT, around a lot of FBT, not FBT, a lot of CGT around family trusts and things like that as well.
Yep.
So it essentially, the government obviously has a very, very large debt. They have to be paying that in billions, millions of dollars a day. All governments are in just interest alone to pay down this debt, let alone we're going into more debt. So it's just getting harder.
Yep.
At the same time, obviously, it's then about efficiencies, right? Like, so for businesses, I think for business people, it's really hard because, you know, I'm just doing a presentation at the moment. And, you know, most businesses have to factor in about 40% of their income is going to go to tax, right? By the time you think about payroll tax that we're correcting, GST that we're paying company tax, and also then payroll tax, that's why most people say that the government is actually about a 40 to 50% shareholder of the businesses because it goes to tax. Yep. And look, that's great. But I think what people forget is the risk that comes with that and the cost and everything, right? And then those businesses are actually employing people as well. So what this potentially does to dampen the economy, it means that, you know, in this case, she just literally turned around and said, I might as well just move to Singapore or the US. She's like, I cannot see how this is going to help small businesses and startups get going and drive entrepreneurs to want to start businesses in Australia because it is. So I think I understand where that is. There's obviously not much to do with, you know, the construction industry, but it does have a downfall effect.
Yeah, it
I
does.
Think people need to understand that the industry is actually made up of, you know, it's got big businesses. But if we look at it as a proportion of the industry, like 80 to 90% of the businesses in the industry are under 20 people. So if you think about that, there's a very, very small percentage. There's a large percentage of businesses who are actually, or, you know, generating economies that are actually going to be quite affected by this and the way that they're structured and what they're going to do, it could mean that we see a lot of collapses. And we saw that obviously with builders and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I think it's just really important because the other side of that is the people who have to build this are actually the trade businesses. And most of those trade businesses are small businesses structured in that way. You think about it, even your typical, you know, electrician working on site, is probably running, they might have the head contractors, the business, then they've got the electrical contractor, and that electrical contractor is then working with other contractors. And a lot of that is about time and where they go. It depends on the size and scale and tier of and unionized of those. But it will potentially have an effect. And I think that's why we're seeing a lot of people getting quite up in arms about it. At the same time, it is important that we pay tax because we need to have roads. We will not be building this stuff without the taxes. So I understand both sides of it. I think the difficult part is, I mean, this person was saying to me, you know, there's a great guy out there, Daniel Priestley, Australian bloke who is in the UK and thinks a lot around entrepreneurial stuff, and said, essentially you've got business people who take risk to start businesses. You've got employees who work really hard to do businesses, and then you've got people who want and may expect things from the economy and those parts. And so I think it will have some potentially big impacts, but we may not see it. We're also dealing, obviously, with delightful Trump and obviously potential of wars or that are being reclassified and the effects that that's having and obviously the effects that that has on trades. And we obviously just spoke about the differences that we've got with obviously the Queensland economy needing this many in. I 100% agree with you. Right now we are so, so short on people in the industry across engineers, architects, designers, you name it, we're short, but we're mostly short of trades to be actually able to come in and to actually be able to build these businesses. So we've had some really interesting podcast conversations around that and how even how the model potentially needs to change. I just don't think the model's going to change anytime soon. So whilst there's lots of opportunities out there, there's obviously lots of challenges that way. But again, you know, we're people, we sort through challenges, we work those things out and we come out the other side.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Sorry, I feel like I did more of the talking on that side of things than you did. You can avoid the politics side. all right. So with all of those things, as I said, there's always opportunities out of that. And sort of where do you see the opportunities in the next sort of, let's say, next 12 months to 5 years, and what Yomni's sort of doing to take on some of those opportunities and changes?
Yeah, and we are doing it and we are leaning into it, and you know, it talks about AI, but it's about automation, and a big focus is, it's not about trying to reinvent the wheel, but if you can remove manual process away and if you can remove some menial tasks away from a human and have them focused on higher value ticket items, whatever they might be, and they're always role specific, that's always going to be helpful and beneficial. And if we, you know, can shorten the time that it's required to deliver a particular outcome and drive through, you know, certain actions, that's always going to be really helpful as well. So yeah, we spend a lot of time around, you know, the systems that we have, the processes, you know, the technology that we have embedded within the business, and, you know, from developing AI agents. So, you know, if you're a new employee, you can come in, you can have a conversation with an AI agent, you know, and go, well, what's the dress code policy, or what's a particular policy on whatever? And instead of, we go through a HRS management system and there's a bunch of different policies and I need to find the specific wording within a policy, it gives you the response straight away and it gives you a link to the policy where you can actually find that. So I think it's even just, you know, removing some of the delay that somebody might have to navigate through. Yeah. You know, we charge for time. We are a consulting business. And so if you can give people more time back, we're all going to be better off for it. And if you think about the work that we do compared to all of our competitors out there, we're all swapping time for money. And so as you know, the largest fire consulting company in Australia, you know, we lean heavily into how can we be efficient? How can we, you know, embrace technology to deliver, you know, the same or better outcomes, you know, at a reduced, you know, reduced time and reduced cost to our clients as well. And so we will continue to lean into that. And for anyone that is early in their journey or contemplating it, it's not about trying to swap out or let's get an AI to replace a human. You know, it's about how can AI operate as an extension of somebody to be more efficient, to reduce the investment of time and to remove some manual handling. And I think if companies have that lens over it and they're focused on, you know, how can we, you know, use it as an extension as opposed to a replacement, I think that's probably a good first step that organizations could take that maybe aren't as advanced as certainly what we are, and maybe aren't as advanced as what some other companies are out there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is a massive part that AI can help us on the operational part. I think the next part we're going to start seeing is in the actual technical elements as well. I think there's going to be some, and different companies are obviously working on their own. And, you know, there's also systems out there that'll be doing the same type of thing. It's about being able to get better outcomes for clients in a quicker process. And, yep. But at the end of the day, it's still about humans operating that or understanding the project, understanding the nuances to be able to do that, to apply it. So it is a tool at the end of the day to be able to help. And I think we're going to see some real changes within that. How are you seeing where that might be changing, you know, I suppose what things might look like for the next 5 years and what that might look like for engineers coming and the types of skills that they need to be focused on building?
You still need an engineer, a registered engineer, to review, approve, do the quality assurance, and then make sure whatever has, you know, by way of a report or designs, whatever has been developed is in line with, you know, the NCC and is compliant and is going to create and drive the right outcome reflective of project requirements. But if you can leverage technology to get to that, you know, review point, you know, in a far quicker way, I think that's where you'll save an incredible amount of time and an incredible amount of money. I'm into robotics, not that I have one, but I will have a robot in my house at some point in time. I'm completely fine with that. But if you go and look at the evolution as far as, you know, robotic technology is concerned, man, it is coming fast. And, you know, if you think about, and I've had this conversation, you know, with different people, you know, go and rewind 5 years, you'd never have an autonomous vehicle getting them out on the roads. But my son just got back from a business trip over in China. And even though the DD and the Ubers that he got into, there was a driver, you know, a person sitting in the driver's seat, all of the ones that he was in, none of them actually touched the steering wheel. It was 100% autonomous. And there were some other DD vehicles out on the road that didn't even have a driver in the seat there as well. So it is here. What they also found really funny, they were whatever hotel they were in and they were coming down from really high level to go and have breakfast, and then the lift doors open. It was just him and his partner in the lift and no one was there, and all of a sudden a robot comes in, makes a bit of space, so they cleared space for the robot. The robot then presses a lower floor, goes down five levels, whatever it might have been, and gets out and goes back off about its business. So like, this technology is out there. There is autonomous robots out there, you know, fulfilling certain tasks and doing a particular job right now that Australia hasn't really scratched the surface of. And so I thought that was just an interesting story.
I mean, you talk about the autonomy. If anybody has a Tesla, they've been able to drive themselves for years. We went and drove one the other day, obviously, with fuel prices, and was like, I just sat there, like, did some illegal things and sort of videoed, was like, this is insane. Like, it just waited for everything. It is here. It's the legislation enabling us to be able to do that. So it's always that fear factor in what it is versus that the tech's already there and has been there for some time. It's probably the one sector, it's the things that can't replace yet, right? Like the complexity of a constructing project is complex, right? Yeah. You know, it'll be certainly able to help with certain things, like we can automate or, you know, modular build. That's probably going to be one of the big things that we might see a change in the future. But essentially it is manufacturing, right? If we are talking modular building. But to custom build something, there, I don't think we're going to be replacing trades. And it's when you look at the whole experts in AI, the one thing they'll say to you is that if you give to your kids, what do you tell them to do? Go and start a trade. So I'm hoping that will actually help us in the future, but that's not going to change for the next few years. I think we're going to see some really big changes in the industry. And I don't think any of us can sit here and know. I think those people are developing, but the speed of now knowledge and how quickly things can be built and how quickly things are changing, in 5 to 6 weeks, things can change enormously.
Yeah. Yeah, you used to be able to put a 2, 3, 4+ year, you know, time horizon over, you know, technology and evolution. And now, you know, you're down to weeks, you're down to months. And certainly, you know, where you start at the beginning of a financial or a calendar year is light years away from where you end up at the end of that particular period. And chatting with a tier one builder a little while ago, you know, they were sharing some of the challenges that they have to navigate through. And on one of their particular sites up here, they were down to 2.5 days productivity a week. So you're paying for full-time resources, but because of the environment and they're tier one, so they're heavily involved with unions, and there can be some benefits to that. 2.5 days a week is the output of what they're getting out of a full-time employee, but you're paying for a full-time employee. Like the expense that an organization needs to wear in order to deliver
Project's wearing. Actually, that's why the construction costs are so high.
Yeah, absolutely. It's incredible. So, you know,
so there's definitely going to be elements. And look, there is advantage of the tier one. There's also reasons why some people don't want to go to tier one for those reasons too. So I think it is around efficiency. And I think that's the really interesting thing is that obviously when we're having that conversation around some budgetary and tax changes, it might look minutiae, but it's probably right now with everything that's going on in technological changes and everything that's going on in the world right now, I think it's actually quite hard to fully predict what the impacts of things is. The good thing about business is businesses will generally look at and how can we make things more efficient. I think for people coming in, it's knowing what those innate skills are that you still need to be building. You still need to know your craft. You still need to do it. It's a tool of the trade to help to simplify that craft. But it is about an understanding. That's about understanding the context of the environment that you work in and how it all works together. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the types of skills that you would be telling graduates and those who want to still be able to build up the right skills to keep themselves employable over the next 10 to 20 years?
Yeah, there'll always be the need for them to be technically proficient, whatever your craft might be. You're a trade, an engineer, a doc, doesn't matter. What I think people need to be mindful of and keep leaning into is the ability to manage and maintain human interaction. And I see some people, I'll just send an email. I don't want to pick up the phone. I don't want to talk to someone. And I think it will inhibit people if they don't have the courage to pick up a phone, to go and have a conversation, to engage. We're all people. We're in it regardless of the roles that we fulfill. And certainly I've observed, not just here, but I've observed over lots of different organizations, especially if, you know, things are derailing and a project isn't on track, the quicker you have a conversation, the quicker you manage expectations by pushing problems down the road, doesn't minimize them. It only makes them larger. Yeah. But I've seen it so many times over. We've got an agreed timeline in place to deliver a particular outcome. I'm not on track, and I know that early within that project, you know, life cycle. But instead of getting on the front foot, picking up the phone, or having a chat and managing expectations, they leave it till the 11th hour, and they're like, "Oh yeah, sorry, I have actually been really busy on that, but I'm not on track." And what people need to be mindful of is it's the domino effect. It's not just your one key stakeholder. It's, you know, the myriad of other people that sit behind that person that are waiting on you to complete a particular task, so they can all go and do a bunch of things there as well. And so I would strongly encourage people to put down your phone, don't hide behind a screen, don't hide behind a keyboard, and develop and continue to practice the craft of engaging with humans, of having a conversation with humans. And I think what's also important, and we have a hybrid working environment, but what is absolutely really important, and I call it the water cooler conversations, not that I think too many businesses have a water cooler these days. You know, you might jump on, you have a Teams call or a Zoom call or whatever, but it's a 2-minute conversation. If you're in the office and you're in a meeting room, as you're walking back to your desk, or as the things you hear via osmosis, if I'm sitting on a pod and I can hear a senior engineer across the other side of the desk there, having a technical conversation with whoever, you just learn by being around. And so, you know, people being at home, being closed off, I just want to, you know, I work better from home. Well, yeah, maybe you could be more efficient. But there is a whole lot of learning that you are missing out on by not
definitely
being in a...
As a graduate, the best thing you can do is get into the office, because you're not going to, it's all the things you learn by observing, the watching, things are going on. But it is innately in who we are as humans. We need to connect with each other. It actually has an effect on our brain, our serotonin levels and everything, that we do have that connection. But it's as simple as, you know, sometimes you see everybody, even if they're on a Teams call, you see the, you know, the PCGs used to be, everybody used to come in and be all that, everybody talking. Now it's all online, right? Most of them are like, people sit there and like, it's like, you actually don't realize, put down your phone, stop looking at the screen, you're in a meeting, give that time, talk to that person, build that personal connection. You need to do that. What did you do on the weekend? You know, what's this? Oh, I don't know. How are you going today? What's this going on? And this is what we talk about. You know, it's a bit of a like a trusted advisor model in building trust in relationships, right? It's actually the little parts of building that personal element, showing you actually genuinely care as a human. And what that does in our brains is actually has an effect on us to want to connect with that person. Right, there's lots of different psychological elements and things that we, you know, we do training on this as well, that are really, really fundamental to how we build relationships and the connections that we have. And then there's also the habits as well. So, you know, it's sometimes those tiny changes in habits and behaviors that can actually change. And you've got to remember, at the end of the day, when you want to go and call on somebody to do something, you need to do having that. I agree. I often am always instructing people, pick up the phone, have a 5-minute conversation. If you feel awkward, that's the moment that tells you you need to pick up the phone, right? And I'd always like to relate things into people's personal lives. It's a little bit like if your girlfriend or partner's upset at you, right, and you're texting away and you're doing something, just call them. Hey, babe, sorry about this. Get on front foot earlier than you can, because it's worse by ignoring it. And these are probably some elements that I think we're losing a little bit as we are very digital and we're becoming more digital and we're now working with, you know, most people probably have a bit of their AI as the bit of a counselor as much as it is anything else. And it's great. It's a free thought and gives things too, but nothing will actually replace human connection. And that's exceptionally important. And I agree with hybrid work. And, you know, we actually run a remote first sort of workplace too. But it's actually how do you make those connections, the actual ability, and it's so important if you have an office and connecting and making those meaningful connections as well. So, great sort of tips on things. Excellent. Now, Rich, we always ask people at the end of this, is there anything like a book, podcast? People, you obviously do lots of podcasting being on the bike, I get that. is there some things that you recommend that people listen to or that you enjoy?
I consume a lot of audiobooks because I can listen to that. And whilst I like riding with a mate, so I also ride, run and walk by myself a lot as well. And I consume a lot of podcasts. And when I consume books, like I don't do novels, I do things that are autobiographies and business and sports related. And then, you know, podcasts, I've got, you know, kind of the same ones that I gravitate back to a lot, from Diary of a CEO. Diary of a CEO, and there's one with Denzel Washington that I don't know what it's called. I found that I regularly listen to. And there's a myriad of other ones, and I just kind of rotate through. And, you know, I was listening to Mark Boris this morning. That was the one that was about the federal, you know, the federal budget. That's what I was listening to at 5 a.m. this morning, and he was interviewing an economist, which was, I found really, really interesting. And so it just depends on, I guess, you know, what mood I'm in on that particular day, whether it's business, whether it's sports, whether it's people navigating through challenges in life. But yeah, I love music, but I don't listen to a huge amount of music. I just find when I'm back and from work, if I'm not having a phone conversation with somebody, just the lights turned off in the office that I'm in, I listen to a podcast or an audio book. And I find also, I do meditate, but I find when I'm out and I'm on the bike or I'm having some alone time, that in itself, and I'm listening to good content, that in itself is a form of meditation. And so it enables me to remove myself from the chaos of my life because it's pretty full, and then just kind of, you know, be alone with my thoughts, and I'm exercising and I'm consuming good positive content. And because I do it, I train every single day, it sets me up for success.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I've barely listened to good content.
I have a very similar, I've had to take a, I can sort of consume one or two audiobooks a week and an enormous amount of things. And I've had to take a little bit of a, just relax for a little moment. But absolutely, my best routine is getting up in the morning, stretching, meditating, exercising. As I said, I've got two small children, so the ability to go out and go for a ride and do things is, we've got to manage that between two of active parents.
Yes.
It is one of those things, but I think it sounds like you've got the perfect routine and something that I completely agree with you. So excellent. Well, if there's any in there, we'll include some more in the show notes, but absolutely. I think it is about what you're sort of saying is good routine, continuous learning, finding things that have interest. And then I find it helps me to get my brain going. And this is interesting. One of our podcasts mentioned the book Drive. I found that fascinating. I hadn't listened to it yet. Really good book as well that I've been starting to listen to lately.
Yeah, nice one.
Excellent. All right, Richard, thank you so much for all of your time and thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me. Have a great day.
What a great chat and what a very interesting insights from somebody who's worked across different businesses and also insights into where we see the industry going and the changes ahead.